Hello everyone and welcome to a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast, which will be available both on iTunes and YouTube. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez, and we have a very special episode today. I'm talking to you from Martin, Tennessee, and right on the other side of the line, I can actually see him here in front of me on the computer, is a man who was born in New York City, and he is based out of there as well. He has been a staple of the jazz scene there in New York City, playing at renowned clubs like the Village Vanguard, Smalls, Burland, and many more. I'm talking about one of the best saxophonists I know, Mr. Chris Byers. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
Great, Anton. Thanks for having me on this podcast, and I appreciate your work and your blog and your podcasting on behalf of this music. So it's my honor to be a part of this. Thank you.
Thank you, and it really is an honor to have you and to have a chance to talk about some of your CDs and to talk about your view on the music and different other things that you would like to talk about. Anything is okay. You can say anything you want here on the Jazz Flashes podcast, which will also be available on the Jazz Flashes blog, jazzflashes.blogspot.com. Well, Chris, in order to start giving a little bit of background for those people out there who may not know your music, who may not know you, we said you were born in New York City. You've been playing there for many, many years. You've been making some really good records that I have followed through the years. How did you begin getting interested in this wonderful thing, which is jazz music?
Well, jazz music is dance music, and actually I became interested mainly on the encouragement of my parents, and they did a great job of parenting an artist. I like to say that I'm from the culturally privileged, not economically privileged, but culturally. Mm-hmm. My parents grew up in a part of Texas that was not culturally privileged, and it was a little bit repressed, and they decided, well, when we have kids, they're going to have every possible access they want to lessons, concerts, you name it, and New York is the place. They're both classical musicians. My dad plays oboe in the New York City Ballet Orchestra, and because it's the ballet, that's dance music. And he, you know, I grew up listening to, I pretty much know all their classic repertoire, and it's all classical music that's great to dance to. So, you know, he had played alto sax before the oboe, and then he had a band director who said, you know, you're going to work a lot if you try this instrument, you play the oboe. And my dad played the oboe, and it took him from Texas to New York, you know, within a few years. So that was a good move, but, you know, he still had a saxophone. He had some records of Charlie Parker that he had gotten when he was a kid, and, you know, he really felt like this music is special. And I think, I mean, for me, there was a connection as a listener between jazz and dance, like ballet music. But a couple of things happened. For one, give me a long answer to your question. I was, as part of this culturally privileged kid, I was part of the New York City Opera and the Metropolitan Opera children's choruses, because that's something you can do as a kid in New York City. Opera companies need kids to play the kids' parts. The opera composers wrote for children, you know, sometimes solo roles, leading roles. And if you don't have a kid, you don't have a good opera company. So there would be auditions, and we had to rehearse twice a week. And I would have five shows a week sometimes. I was like 9 years old. But of course, as you know, is always the case with a young male soprano or alto, there comes a day when it's all over. And, you know, one day I was in the treble clef, the next day I was in the bass clef, and it was, you know, pretty disappointing, because I was 13, 14, something like that. And my dad said, you know, why don't you try this saxophone, because that's always going to be there for you. It's not going to just stop like your voice did. And I just got really interested in you know, he gave me Bird and Diz and Bird with Strings. So I didn't have a chance. I mean, of course I was going to love it. That's the two greatest records ever. I mean, Monk, you know, comping for Bird and Diz, and then Bird playing all those great arrangements. And so I was hooked. I went into the basement in on a summer vacation, basically, and spent 3 weeks, beautiful weather, in the basement learning saxophone. And I came out and I could play some stuff. I could take the A-Train, Star Wars theme, you know, fun stuff. And that was it. It really, you know, that it's been saxophone ever since then. But I mean, I have, you know, also insisted on writing a lot of music for people and bothering my friends that way. So yeah, that's kind of the story. You know, it started out with classical music in Texas and wound up on the jazz bandstand in Greenwich Village, you know, 50 years later.
So you began with classical music, and then you turned to the classical music of the 20th century, so to speak.
Exactly.
And you've mentioned Charlie Parker. Of course, you know, I remember Charlie Parker being one of the very first saxophonists I ever heard. Believe it or not, together with Tex Beneke. But what other musicians would you say in those early years influenced you besides Byrd?
Well, I'd have to point my finger to a couple of people I knew in person, and they're still with us. Of course, my colleague Ari Roland, a bassist who I've recorded with, you know, regularly for 30 years, and our teacher Barry Harris. So these guys were very encouraging to me and very informative as to, you know, how the New York City jazz sound is formed and what is hip and what isn't, and, you know, what does it mean to be right but trying too hard? What does it mean to, you know something that is helpful musically and to, you know, how to be a team player, all kinds of, you know, how to play a melody, how to play a ballad, how to play an up-tempo, how to play the blues, all kinds of stuff. Who to call, you know, what tunes to call, what players to call, you name it. These guys have been really helpful. One is my contemporary, but he got a very early start. He was with Barry when he was, I think, 11, mm-hmm. or, you know, it was just a little tyke. And actually, we have another guy in our band who did that, which is Pasquale Grasso. He's just 20 years younger than us, but when he was 11, he was hanging out with Barry, and he's a fantastic musician. So yeah, I would point to those two, Ari Roland, Barry Harris. Thank you both.
And you know, you've been a professional musician for many, many years now, but when was the moment, do you remember a moment when you thought, this is what I want to do, I want to be a professional musician, I want to play jazz for a living?
Yeah, well, actually, that was in the basement in the summer vacation. I just said that's what I'm going to do. I went to a math and science school, which is, for high school, the best in New York City and arguably the United States, Stuyvesant High School. Strangely, the same one that Thelonious Monk went to, although he didn't do so well. He never graduated. He just stopped going after a while because he was working. He was, you know, playing gigs. But one nice thing they do in this school is all extracurriculars are run by students, and I got the opportunity to run the jazz combo. I led the jazz big band, and I conducted the orchestra for the school plays, and that's great. I graduated high school with experience with, like, directing large ensembles, so I think that helped a lot. And I mean, it was it was really, my parents, the cultural, you know, folks, they insisted that I go to the math and science school and not the music and art school because they wanted me to have a well-rounded start. But I think, you know, a side, like, fortunate aspect of that was just the leadership opportunity. If I had gone to music and art, there's no way I would have led anything. There was, you know, like, Omar Hakim was there a few years before me. I forget, this is the roster of people that came out of music and art, LaGuardia High School. It's just like the cover of Downbeat magazine. So, you know, you're never a big fish in that pond. Yeah, so I remember leading my first gig at a club called the Angry Squire on 23rd and 7th Avenue, and I guess it was 19, in a quartet, and Greg Hutchison was on drums, a guitarist named William Ash, and strangely, I didn't have Ari on that. I don't know why, I can't remember. We had a bassist named Nathan Berg, and I think after that, I just hired Ari for everything, pretty much. But that was a big start, you know, the Angry Squire gig, 1989.
And you grew up in New York City, which in many ways is the place to be for jazz. It's not only you know, the one of the cultural capitals of the world, but if you want to play jazz, that definitely is one of the best places to be. What was it like growing up in New York as somebody who wants to be a jazz musician? What were the positive things and maybe the not so positive things of being in such a huge place like the Big Apple?
Okay. Well, on the plus side, we got access to just about everybody that can help you. Instrument repair people, sales people, teachers. I've developed a good friendship with a discographer, Noel Cohen, who lives not far. Noel introduced me to Teddy Charles. He helped me with Freddie Redd, and he's the guy that wrote the book on G.G. Grice.
And that's a great book, actually. One of my favorites, really. One of the best jazz books I've read lately.
Rat Race Blues, not to be missed, not to be overlooked by anybody that likes reading a good book. Can be somebody who's not even crazy about jazz. They'll love that book. It's a great book. And what else? Oh, one other thing. Noel helped me do a research paper on Lucky Thompson and wrote liner notes for one of Lucky's, like, you know, undiscovered material records. Like, he's done a lot of stuff. He's a really helpful guy. So in New York, you can meet people like this. They tend to gravitate here. These days it's challenging. New York is a little more of a financially based, and by that I mean not that everyone cares about money, which of course they do, and it's kind of always been like that. But actual financial professionals, that's who's kind of migrating to the city, and the artists are getting forced out by high rents, and the venues are raising their prices, so it's hard to pay a cover charge. It's hard to draw. Like, the supply is really high and the demand is just what it would be for any other city. It's not like the audience moved here because it's the capital of the culture. They didn't. The audience is just everywhere. And you've got a city. You've got a city of people that do, you know, they're teachers, they run the subway, they deliver the mail and drive taxis, just like any other city. And so they're not as turned on about jazz as the supply side of it is. And man, I mean, there's, you know, a different tenor player on every corner, you know. So, of course, this has an economics angle to it, supply and demand. And so it's hard to make a living. Really, what you have to do with New York, I've found, is you have to leave New York. You have to travel. But then you have to spend time here and be exposed to what you do get from people. Now, what that is, it is very helpful on a fundamental level. I'd say a positive result of being in New York is, I mean, this is really basic stuff, but hearing intonation. Someone said once to me, it takes 6 months to sound like you're not from out of town anymore. And the reason why this is, it's a funny thing, a pitch, E flat, you know, let's say, is not going to be in the same spot depending on what's going on. Okay, if E-flat is the minor third of C minor, it's going to be in one place. If it's the fifth of A-flat minor, it's going to be in a different place based on just a ton of stuff, you know, how we tuned up today and all of that. But it relates to the bass note. And depending on what that interval is, if it's a minor interval, major interval, perfect, augmented, etc., you have to hear it. Now, instruments like the piano are tuned as a giant compromise so that it always sounds almost okay, like almost perfect. But when you get, let's say, an a cappella chorus, all the singers can adjust slightly so that you get these really resonant intervals, and if they really know the sound of what they're doing, at, like where their note fits in. It in classical music, I think it's just a question of knowing the piece. You know, here this will sound better if I just play it this way. They might not even know really what they're doing, in a detail oriented way, but because they hear it, and that we always talk about hearing. You know, how do you hear the harmony? How do you hear your part? So, for example, you can't really play a piece the first time and sound good because you don't know where your notes lay, you know, on the harmony. It's a surprise. And with New Yorkers, they tend to, the more they nail something, the more they shape that intonation to make these resonant intervals. And something like the saxophone, you can adjust just with the tension in your jaw and your lip exactly where that pitch should go. So something like this, when you leave town, you may not encounter that kind of, you know, playing with other people, and you'll lose it. You know, you need to sharpen that up and be here. Now that's intonation. There's a whole other similar thing with rhythm and the attention to detail that rhythm has. And with rhythm, if I can draw a parallel, a lot of people like baseball. Our greatest on-base hitter guy, Pete Rose, who's not in the Hall of Fame because he gambled, but he's the greatest hitter in a way. He would look the ball into the bat. He would turn his head and just make sure that ball hit the bat. And it's kind of like that with rhythm. You have to guide, you know, to the last millisecond, where is this beat? A lot of people go on memory. They'll kind of set up this concept of, okay, like for example, how we get through our day. At 4 o'clock, I'm going to do this. 5 o'clock, this happens. 6 o'clock, this happens. Now, you can get through that pretty effectively without checking your watch. You know, you just kind of estimate. Never look at the clock. But you're not going to be on time. You're not going to walk in to your third appointment at 6 o'clock unless you've been checking your watch. And you're not going to walk in right at 6 o'clock unless you were looking at your watch at like 5:59 and 45 seconds or something. And so it's this kind of detail that I think New York musicians have to rhythm. The ones that are concentrating, the ones that are wanting to do well. You know, of course, there's all different levels, and this can be accomplished somewhere else. But it's just kind of what I see in terms of habits and what people expect of each other here is this attention to rhythm. You got to pay attention. You got to live in this present moment all the time. You know, just because you sounded good 10 seconds ago doesn't mean it's going to work now. You got to concentrate and just look that ball right into the bat all the way. You know, so those are two sort of positive things. I think the intonation and the rhythm. I can go on and on, though, with elements of music, repertoire, tempos. People, you know, play faster here. They'll play a slow ballad. They'll play all these medium tempos that are harder to play than people realize. And obscure tunes, you got to keep that repertoire interesting for people. You don't want to keep playing the same songs. I could list you 10 songs right now that I'm really sick of hearing, you know, out in the rest of the world that need to just get X'd. Let's get another 10, people. All right, so Anton, not to sound, you know, New York-centric, though, because it is about spreading this music everywhere and incorporating the styles of, you know, we come back with music from abroad and we play it. We come back with musicians from abroad and we say, you know, you're moving here. You're too good. You know, come on. Well, I need you in my band. I have two guys on what's it called? I want to say A1 visas. In my band, two Italians, and you know, so there's a relationship with New York and the outside world. But I like to call it New York City jazz. The concept is, you know, how does the music sound from here, informed by, you know, the years of tradition. Anton, we have local cats here who were never really that famous, but have been part of, like, just carrying the ball forward all these years. Jazz weddings, you know, no one really, like, made the cover of Downbeat by playing a jazz wedding, but there's some guys that sound great, and that's how they've made their living over the years, you know, just playing some cocktail party or something. and they're excellent musicians. You won't hear about it, but they're part of our scene. You know, teachers, ensemble players, you know, that aren't leaders, and they're just in a big band. They've got a lot of heart when they play. So it's about all these guys. You know. Two I'd like to mention are Frank Hewitt and Jimmy Lovelace. I don't know if those are names you would know from the days of Smalls Records. It was the predecessor to Smalls Live. And, yeah, Frank Hewitt, great pianist, and Jimmy Lovelace, my favorite drummer of all time, really, I mean, that I got to play with. Although I love a lot of drummers. They're great. This guy was just incredible. So local talent, nobody really heard of him. I mean, Jimmy played with Wes Montgomery and George Benson, but so what? You know, that so did a lot of people. And he was just one of the best. It was like playing with Max Roach. So, all right. Well, Anton, I've answered 9 different questions. I'm sorry. What else would you like to talk about?
I was just X-ing them off the list here. Now I don't need to ask them anymore because you've covered most of them.
Well, we can talk about it again. I mean, I don't mind going around in circles a little bit, and hopefully it's interesting to people.
You're listening to a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez, talking to you from Tennessee and over in New York City. We have Chris Byers, and we're very happy to have you here today. And there's lots of questions that I would like to ask you, but it doesn't really matter where the conversation takes us. That's basically what the podcast is about, just chatting about jazz in the best possible way, and just talking about the music that we... Chris Byers is very much of a New York jazz musician, but he does not restrict his playing to that city. He has traveled the world taking jazz to different parts of the globe, over 45 countries or so, because not only is he a musician, but he is also a jazz educator. He is a cultural ambassador for the U.S. State Department, and as I said, has traveled the world bringing jazz music to different parts of the world. So one thing that I've always been interested in talking to you about is that experience of traveling abroad, traveling overseas, and bringing jazz to other parts of the world. I was born in another part of the world myself, and I was actually living in Europe when I first encountered jazz through Benny Goodman and Bill Evans. Those were the first two musicians that I heard almost concurrently, really, thanks to jazz records that my dad had, and that's what originally got me hooked up on jazz, really. And what I would like to know is, when you travel abroad, when you go to Europe, when you go to the Middle East or Japan, different places like that, what is the reception, the reaction to jazz that people abroad have that may be different from the way it is received here in the United States?
Well, okay. Oh, Anton, could you turn me down a little? I'm getting that echo.
I will. Sure. All right, maybe now.
Okay, so... Of course, when something, you know, doesn't belong to you, you value it more. But I do want to, you know, caution people that jazz is not the property of the United States by any means. We owe a lot to international musicians and audiences these days. You know, it started here and it was good for the United States, but it's for everybody. It always has been for everybody. It's, you know, the ultimate people's music. So what do people do? Well, I played in Germany recently and Russia and the Netherlands. I played in Central Asia. That's all this year. And, you know, it's different from culture to culture. But generally, what I see is just a better... For the lack of another term, better listening technique. I mean, people are calmer, able to sit and open their ears and be patient, you know, for a longer period of time. I think attention is the new, you know, gold bullion. It's the currency that it rules the world. I mean, of course, people think it's money, but if you get people's attention, then you've got it, you know. And it's harder for, I think, cultures that are so rewarded with instant gratification and, you know, being led, being dragged through something as per the wishes of the, you know, the composer or program or whatever it is. You know, true listening is about being open and reflecting. How does this thing relate to me and my life and my life experience? And honestly, my dear, you know, American, you know, brothers and sisters out there, we can do better. You know, we are just gobbled up by our culture of television, video games, social media, and you know, running around this demand of enhanced productivity that we have. I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean really used to help us out in some ways. But right now, if we all went on a vacation in Holland and saw how they lived and how hard they're working for the life that they're leading, we would be shocked. You know, we're on a hamster wheel here, comparatively. And I think this is reflected in their listening. They're just in better shape to give their attention and appreciation to something, and then to reflect on their own lives. I mean, honestly, music is in the ear of the beholder. It's the interpretation of these sound waves and these you know, deviations in air pressure as it hits the ear and interpreted by the brain. That's all in the listener's head. What I do, you know, it's an event, but unless it's heard and understood and interpreted, it actually doesn't happen. It's no different than, you know, a car hitting a pothole and making a sound. So we need this, you know, and we're in this symbiotic sort of natural relationship with the listener, and it's wonderful to see entire audiences, 500 people sitting, just like gobbling up what you're doing, and then, you know, asking insightful questions afterwards that you say, like, wow, this person really got it. This person got it in a way that maybe I need to get it. You know, I'm learning from them. And imagine this, Anton, you know, veteran listeners. We have them here in New York, but they're getting old. Some of them are passing away. When they come to my show, I am so thrilled. You know, they've heard the greatest musicians. These guys sat and listened to Dizzy Gillespie, and now those same ears are going to hear what I do. Wow. You know, mm-hmm. That's amazing. So I really appreciate listeners overseas. Definitely. They've got an edge on us, you know, and I, God bless them. Hey, I don't care if they're, you know, better. That's great. Somebody's good. You know, we need to, you know, get off our hamster wheel and smell the roses while we're still here, you know, and enjoy these things. We are just too busy and frenetic and panicked, and we want our little sugar fix, you know, and there's better things in life, you know.
Now, that goes to show that jazz does have an international audience, a global audience, and that actually goes back to, you know, the 1950s and 1960s, when there were many great jazz musicians here in the United States that couldn't make a living as musicians here on American soil, and they would move to Europe and or to other parts of the world, and they were sometimes better received over there than they were in their own home soil, so to speak. Sure. Do you think that's something that's still happening in a way that jazz musicians in particular could make a better living by playing Japan or by playing Scandinavia or, you know, some parts of the world like that?
Well, it exists in all directions. So you've got musicians that come here to be a part of this scene. You've got musicians that move from here to be there in college positions or band positions like the WDR or Metropole, something like that, these European radio orchestras. And, you know, you've got also people, well, everybody really must do this at some point, just go on the road and play a month, you know, on tour. This is how you make a living, but it's also cross-pollinization of the mutual scenes, you know. And gosh, Anton, that goes back thousands of years. The musicians always traveled. I forget, I was in Central Asia, and I heard, it was Tajikistan, I heard a story from a local music fan who said, you know, we at one point had a conflict with, two Central Asian nations. Of course, the nations back then were much smaller. They were tribes. And so to settle the conflict, each one sent their best musician. And the musicians, played mutual concerts. And the audience decided, that was the better concert. So your tribe wins this time. You can imagine that.
Sort of like the Olympic Games of music.
Yeah. So, the musicians back then, they would travel and pick up stuff along the way. The Silk Road. There were musicians on the Silk Road. And it's there's so much music out there, so many things to benefit from. I love how Eastern music morphs into Western music and back and forth. Just as you go out with the degrees of, I guess it's longitude. What's the one that goes up and down? Latitude, longitude. As you go from east to west or west to east, it just gets a little bit more toward the other side of the spectrum.
Now, you've been teaching for a long time, but when did this relationship with the U.S. State Department begin?
Well, it was on a lark. Ari had gotten an email saying, there's an audition tomorrow at Jazz Lincoln Center for bands that want to go out on the road for 30 days. And we had nothing ready. And in one night, we got everything ready. Now, we had some recordings and photos and all that, but it wasn't assembled. Ari had to scribble out some essays, and we had to come up with an educational plan, stayed up all night. Went in there, we got to the second round. We got in the final. I guess they picked 10 bands. And I think that was 2006. And that was the tour. It went to Russia, Turkmenistan, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Saudi Arabia. And we got another one the next year. We did it under my name. That first one was Ari Roland Quartet. The second one was mine. We went to Bahrain, Syria, Oman, Jordan, and Cyprus, and one other place that I'm forgetting. In there, Lebanon, no, Kuwait. And the more we did this kind of thing, we would develop associations with the people in each country, both musicians and the embassy people. And the United States Embassy is under, this hiring code where you can't stay in one place too long, because as an American, you will become, more sympathetic to the Japanese, than you are to the United States. So they have to move you around. And so what that meant is after a few years, everybody we knew in one country was now in another country. And we could just say, hey, how about Pakistan? Want us there? And before you knew it, I think we've hit 60 countries now by 2016, 2017. And a lot of those we've been to multiple times. I think we've done 130 programs, something like that. And that's not program days. That's programs, so 5 days, usually average. A lot of time out there in the embassies. And that's been wonderful. It was the same thing that Dizzy and Benny Goodman and Dave Brubeck and Count Basie and Duke Ellington.
Louis Armstrong,
thank you, all did. In the late 50s, the jazz ambassadors. I've been called a jazz ambassador. I humbly, don't accept that because, A, I've got a lot of learning to do with the jazz part, and B, ambassadors are people that are really amazing, diplomats that work their whole lives to become that title. And for me to go on one tour and be called that is kind of ridiculous. Although it's sweet, Prez is, Lester Young and all that. I get it, but
the way I see that is if you're going to be an ambassador, what better thing to be an ambassador for than jazz, right?
Well, for me, for sure, that's true. And in that spirit, I will accept the title. Absolutely.
As you were saying, these programs with the State Department go back many decades. In the current political climate and economic climate that we're living in now at the beginning of 2017, when we've been hearing so much about how many cuts there are going to be with the humanities and the arts and that sort of thing, do you think programs like this are in peril of disappearing or being cut back too much? Do you have any idea about that?
Absolutely. That's exactly what's happening. And it's not even that there was an order as such. The embassies are fearful, and they don't want to spend their money on something that isn't like, we're going to need food, you know. We can't starve out here, because if we go outside, we might get in trouble. I mean, it's that simple. So, the current administration is not friendly to the arts. And, I like to think it swings back, back and forth, but we haven't seen a lot of that, actually, on both sides. It seems to be moving, away from funding and valuing the arts. And they say, well, the private sector, but really, you can't count on that, because the private sector is really about profit. And so if you're going to only let what is profitable thrive, then everything's going to be based on a popularity contest. And you're going to have things like, American Idol, The Biggest Loser, that's going to be your jazz. It's going to be contest winners. And contest winners generally are successful because they're satisfying to the broadest palette of understanding listeners. So, that's not really what the great musicians were going for. They weren't saying, how do I make everyone happy? They went for their artistic vision, and you came along. You think Thelonious Monk was trying to make everyone happy?
No, I hope he was at least trying to make himself happy. But
well, that's right, and he was playing for the people, but he was not going to change what he did because he wasn't understood, and our understanding grew as a result of that. And now his music, we're getting around to understanding. He still sounds like he's a modern guy. It still sounds like he's playing now. So in this environment, is someone like him going to thrive? It's tougher. Of course he can. Of course anybody can. Until they say no more music allowed, anything is possible. But, it's tougher now. And I look forward to what we need to realize is when things are taken away, that it's just as important to get them back and then some. Take it back and then expand on what you got back, because then you get the balance that's right. If you just get it back where it was and then it goes away again, you're going to get the balance is halfway in between nothing and what you want, and that's not acceptable. So let's go for it, and let's value the arts. Let's teach our kids. Let's encourage youngsters. Let's come out and let's download a 99-cent iTunes thing instead of listening to it on YouTube. And put a dollar out there, towards the artist. These days, like buying a CD or something, it's like voting in a local election, where like the mayor's race is decided by 3 votes. It really counts. The CD sales of artists used to be, 10,000 was like a successful CD.
Mm-hmm.
I got news. 10,000 is wildly successful now. You're a success if you sell 1,000. It's pathetic numbers. It's really hard to get people to pay for stuff. So if you pay for something, it matters more than ever.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a huge impact. That artist will feel that. And it counts. It really counts to their survival. So,
which obviously means, that what you're saying reminds me that, of course, recording CDs, making albums is no longer, if it has ever been, but it's no longer the primary source of income for musicians, definitely not in jazz. So that is something that has really changed in the last, say, 20 years or so.
Yeah. When I was coming out of college, I remember this goal. Someone said, so what do you want to have? What's your goal? What's wild success? And I said, I want a record contract. That's what I want to have, which is foolish because look, I know we'd be nowhere without records because we wouldn't be able to hear great musicians. But from an artist's side, actual recording is a drag. You go to this cold room and there's no audience, and you got to play it perfect or else they make you play it again. And by the third or fourth time you're playing a song, you're sick of it. It's like that. You don't want to go in the studio. You want to play live. You want to play concerts. You want to play great gigs. That should have been my goal. But anyway, here I was. What did I know? I want a record contract. And that goal doesn't exist anymore. There are no record contracts. Really, it's very hard to get one. You have to be some kind of megastar. And inevitably, if you are a megastar, which I hope that happens for everybody, there are other dues you have to pay. It's a drag too. It's a drag to be in that position. For example, all the stars now that were expecting to make $5 million and they made $2 million, they have people mad at them to the tune of $3 million. Mm. I don't have anyone mad at me to the tune of $3 million, so I'm doing much better than they are. This you're right. This has changed. What we have now is live streaming. We have direct contact with people on a new scale, where you can engage your fans. You kind of have to do it automated on some levels, because you just don't have time to talk to thousands of people. Mm-hmm. So Facebook posting is one way to keep people up on the what's going on. Instagram, that kind of stuff. And yeah, YouTube is helpful, but it's, the problem is it's free. And Anton, if I told you one day, I put out on a fruit stand, here are avocados and they're perfect and they're free, and next week free, right? And then a week after that, avocados are now $2. No one's going to buy the avocados because they were free last week. Mm-hmm. Now they're not free. We're not buying. And this is what's happened with music. Like if I can get something for free, and now you tell me I got to pay for it, I'm gonna pass. I'm gonna listen to music I already have. So that's where we're at. I wish it weren't the case, but it was a pretty unnatural 100 years anyway. This recording thing, that was weird. You mean to tell me I could put my headphones on and through my eardrums I can hear music that I'm not hearing in the rest of my body? And the people are dead or they're not in the room with me. Like, what the hell is that, man? Let's get in the same room with our musicians and support them and be present. Like, that is the process. That's the Paleolithic way to do this. And it's always going to ring a lot truer. Our bodies are made out of water, and sound carries through water. You can hear a whale 20 miles away, or a whale can hear another whale. When we are physically moved by music, on a molecular level, it repairs our bodies. It repairs our souls on a level we can't understand. And this recording thing is not really where it's at. We got to hear it live. We got to go out and check the music and let it hit us.
Well, at the same time, it's nice to have recordings of some of those gigs. Oh, yeah. So that you can actually listen to it when you haven't had the chance to be there. Living in Tennessee, I can understand how difficult it is for somebody like me who really likes jazz and would like to be able to see live jazz music. And whenever I see you post or Carol Sloan's posts about on Facebook about the different gigs that you've been to or that you're playing as a part of, I feel jealous because I just don't have that chance living in Northwest Tennessee. I'm not going to bash Northwest Tennessee necessarily, but musically, especially when it comes to jazz, unless you go to Nashville and then not so much, it's very difficult to actually stay in touch with the music that you love. But I totally agree with what you're saying about the recording industry, and I do agree with you also that it has been a pretty unusual 100 years in that respect.
Yeah, and things will always change. We're at the end of this revolution, so it's guaranteed to morph into something else. But just to respond to the point you made though about Northwest Tennessee, a couple of things. First of all, you're an unusual guy because you really care about this and you put a lot of time and attention and effort into not only, enriching yourself, but passing on that knowledge and information to others. Would that everyone were like you. Now, to the people that maybe aren't quite as committed, which is most of us, I would say two things. First of all, when that concert does come around, whether it's the once a year jazz festival or, you know, somebody at the local theater is coming, you got to go. You know, you got to check it out. And, you know, maybe it's not your cup of tea, but, you know, check it out anyway. Be there, because when there is a happening, you don't know what's going to happen. And that's something cool about being alive. That's being present in this moment. It's a gift. You know, it's amazing that we're here and that we've gone, you know, our ancestors all survived to childbearing age so we could be here in this moment. Don't miss the concert, you know. But then the second thing I want to say is that great music happens at any level. And I've, you know, on the negative side of that, I've seen like some of the top billed players come together and they leave me cold. But, you know, some of my favorite concerts have been student concerts. I don't care if somebody's like hitting the high, you know, whatever on the trumpet or playing double time or playing the world's most complicated tune. If they're playing with feeling and they mean what they say, it's just as fulfilling. And gosh, when you're surprised that they're pulling it off, it's even more exhilarating because there they are. They're giving it their all and using the thing that's going to happen. That's lovely. So, you know, to look closely at what is being offered in the school band or the school play or you know, the orchestra that you got to drive a half an hour to see that maybe is not the top, but, you know, look what they did. There's all kinds of stuff going on, and they need audience. They need to be heard, and it's good to hear them. So, yeah, there's more options than you think. Maybe Northwest Tennessee, you got to drive 100 miles. I don't know. But to just take those opportunities when you can to the listeners, I'm saying. And, of course, listening to this podcast is an excellent way to not only develop themselves and enrich themselves, but to stay up on current events. You know, what did they miss? How did it go? What's coming up and all of that. So, you know, they're in tune. They got a good chance. If they're on board with this, you know, they're going to be okay.
You're listening to a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez, and we have with us today, not here in my office, unfortunately, but on the other side of the cyber line here, Chris Byers, who has some really interesting things to say, and I really am really interested, and I agree in with pretty much everything that you have said so far. And it's not—it's a rare chance that I get to talk to somebody like you, and you know, whom I have been following for several years. And actually, when you listen, you know, when I listen to your records, to the CDs that I've been listening to for several years, I see that there's something that I really like about you, which is not just the style or the way that you play, or you know. But also the deep knowledge and understanding that I think you have about the history of jazz. And to me, that's very important. And also, something that is, to me, even more important than that is the attention that you pay to some of the jazz greats from the past that are not very well remembered in many cases these days. You know, people like Gigi Grice or Lucky Thompson or Duke Jordan or Frank Strozier. I like the fact that you are bringing their music back and making it available for new audiences in these new times. This is something that I wish more people did, and I'm sure there are many other people who do this out there, but it is one of the things that have always attracted me to your record. So it's just a comment, but the question would be... why are you interested in the work of these great jazzmen who are, in many cases, forgotten these days? What is it that drives you to their music?
Well, okay, thank you for asking, Anton. It's been a major focus of what I've been doing for, it's I guess 12 years now. Started out with some grant proposals that I did. You know, I just had this idea of, well, you know, what if we went in depth on a particular composer and just looked at all of what they did? I want to tell you a little bit about the first really successful project I did, which was the Lucky Thompson tribute. And I got to speak with him on the phone before he died. He was a little mentally, unbalanced in the phone call. He suffered from, I believe, paranoid schizophrenia for decades. And I was able to get him on the phone like by a miracle. And, he really didn't know what he was saying. But at one point he said, I don't care what a player plays unless they mean it. That's what I'm listening for, is what do they mean what they're playing? That's all I listen for. So what I did with him was, in the indulgence of Mitchell Borden and Smalls Jazz Club, I put on four nights of music where we played, I believe it was 60 of his tunes. It was a couple months of transcribing and arranging and rehearsing. We did a trio, quartet, quintet, and octet, one night each. And what I was amazed by in that effort was the ability for Lucky Thompson to be himself in multiple manifestations. Being a one-hit wonder is a little bit more possible than to be prolific. To be prolific, you might be writing that same song over and over again. And actually, this was something Monk said about Gigi Grice. He said, I always know it's a Gigi tune, which is amazing, because how do I know it's him if it's a tune I haven't heard before? And it's not the same tune, right? That's a good trick, you know. So there's something about the behavioral decision making that goes on in the composition that tells us who it is. And all of these writers have it. Freddie Redd has his way of going about it. I could write you a tune like him, and use the kind of decision making styles that he would make, and you go, yeah, that does sound like Freddie. But also, I could do that with Duke Jordan. I could do it with Teddy Charles. It's been fun over these years of studying these composers to just pick that up, you know, a kind of a way of dealing with things, like this mystical personality that they have that exists in simple choices, like chess moves. How can you have personality in a chess move? But it's there. It really is there. Yeah, I've gotten a lot out of it. It's been a wonderful process, and the people that have been with me along this journey, John Mosca, Ari Roland, Stefan Schatz, Zayd Nasser, Keith Bala on drums sometimes, Sasha Perry on piano, we've all had a great time learning this stuff. We got to play with Freddie Redd. We got to play with Teddy Charles. And like I said, I spoke to Lucky Thompson. Oh, the Gigi Grice program was really sweet. You know, as you read Rat Race Blues, you know the story about how he became a teacher. And I hope you're comforted that, as you're a teacher as well.
Yes.
he was a very intense and successful elementary school teacher. He, the way he went about it, you would have thought he was a college professor, but he's teaching little kids. And expecting so much out of it. Well, it's so interesting. But, you know, as a resident of the Bronx, I had his former school within 5 miles of my house. And so we set up a program in that school to play the music of Gigi Grice. And his son, Bashir Grice, and his widow, Eleanor, for whom the tune Eleanor was written, came to the school and saw our program and took a bow in front of these kids. By the way, that school is named after him now. It's the Gigi Grice School, Bashir Kassim Gigi Grice Elementary School, PS 53. And this was like really cool. You know, there were a couple of teachers that were old that were still there from when they were young and Gigi was teaching, and they talked about him. They said he was the best teacher they'd ever seen in anything, like any, not music, but any teaching. And so we felt like we had a chance to really touch history and to, kind of stir up the paint can a little bit. It was really fun. So, by the way, our writer, Noel Cohen, he came to that and he talked to the kids. And we really got to play. I felt like it was a CSI cold case, you know. The trail had been dropped 20 years earlier. Here we are on the same plan. You know, here's this music. It's really, really great, really fun.
You know, when you mention that about teaching, Chris, it really hits home to me, for me, because I always tell my students that the only reason why you would become a teacher is because you really like to teach. I don't think there could be any other reason why you would become, for example, a Spanish teacher or a music teacher, a math teacher, because, first of all, you're not doing it for the money. Because there's not really a lot of money in it. You have to be doing it for another reason, because you really love the subject, because you really love to pass on the knowledge to other people, because you really like to make an impact on certain, not all, of course, of the students. And so I always tell my students who want to go on to have to study and get a master's or a PhD even, I always say, you know, make sure you really like doing this, because if you don't, you know, you will hate it and the students will hate it as well. So I totally, when I read that story that you mentioned about Gigi Grice and the now you're bringing up, I realize, you know, how much of teaching really lies in the, I wouldn't say the soul, but at least in the personality of the person who teaches. And you've been teaching music for many years, which really shows that you probably have that sort of mindset that we're talking about.
Oh, Anton, I love it. I love getting in front of people who are excited about music and then sharing information. I always see it as a two-way street, you know, that I don't know everything, and if they know something or they can do something I can't do, you know, let's see it, you know, let me be open to that. You have to be. But I think you're right. It's about falling in love. You got to be in love with it. And how do you keep that magic going? Yeah, that's an ongoing thing. It's not, you know, save to a folder and store in the hard drive forever. It's not like that. You got to cultivate this and maintain it, you know, effortfully develop what you're doing. I've felt that with music, you know, over these, in my 30s and then in my 40s. It's been an ongoing, you know, day one. Every day is kind of day one in a way. It has to be. So, for teachers out there, yeah, it's fun. You know who I had as a teacher? I had Frank McCourt, Angela's Ashes. He was my creative writing teacher at Stuyvesant. And this guy, you know, to all the teachers out there, if you want to read his third book called Teacher Man, it's a wonderful account of when he was teaching at my school, you know, the various things that would go on, and just the way he was in love with what he taught is an example to us all, actually in any profession. But, you know, if you're a teacher, yeah, you gotta follow his lead. And it was really, you know, he boiled it down. He said, I want to lead my students away from fear and lead them towards love. That's my only goal. Get away from the fear, go towards the love. That's what I'm always trying to do.
That's a very good way to sum it up, really. And, you know, no wonder Frank McCourt is such a great writer. I think it must have been a great, you know, you must have great memories of those classes.
Well, he was so in abandon of tradition, of expectations. You know what he did with me? Chris, we don't really care about the writing. Just bring in the saxophone and play for the class. That's all you have to do. Stick with the music. It's okay. Don't worry. You know, he didn't care if I did the assignments. Just come in and play us another one of your songs. That's where your heart is, you know? So I do that once a month and then just sit back and enjoy what everybody else was doing. He would do all kinds of crazy stuff.
There's something about jazz, Chris, though. I don't know what it is that has really brought about some great pieces of writing. Throughout history, you know, some of the jazz criticism that I have read by some of the you know, great jazz critics, especially when they don't get into the technical aspect of music too much, which would be hard for me to follow sometimes, But you have some great essays written throughout the 20th century and even now that deal with jazz. So I have the feeling there's something about this specific kind of music that inspires some great writing.
It's probably the degree to which it can be interpreted by the listener and how they reflect on their own lives. It's just a big cue for someone to give off their emotion and put it into words. Yeah. Not only that, I don't know, you can see on my video feed, there's a sketch of someone that was at my octet performance, and they just like put the charcoal on the page and off they went. It inspires visual artists, all kinds of stuff. It's very open-ended and it's jazz is a gift. It's a gift to the human race, to inspire us and help us elevate our consciousness to be better prepared for the decisions we have to make.
I agree. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the records that I have right here and that you can see on the live video feed. Mm-hmm. Chris Byers, The Music of Frank Strozier, and this is an album that was recorded in December of 2015, but it has just been released now in 2017 by mm-hmm. the Danish label Steeplechase. It's a really, I don't know if, sometimes people use the word legendary a little too much, but this is a label that has been around for a long time, and many great jazz musicians of the past and the present have recorded for this Danish label. And this album I have in my hand has 10 Frank Strozier originals that have been arranged by Chris Byers. Could you explain a little bit what Frank Strozier and his music means to you and the songs that you have chosen here? Has there been any, what kind of thought process was involved in this project, and how did this project come about?
Well, it's Frank Strozier's music was just like the other, five or six guys I've done, Duke Jordan, Teddy Charles, Freddie Rich, Eugene Grice, Lucky Thompson, and I'm forgetting one. I just pulled all of his originals together that I could find on sheet music and audio, and Noel Cohn was a big help with that. He's already done the work. He's a discographer, so he's got a page on Frank Strozier ready to go with dates and Sidemen and all the titles and everywhere you could find the records. I got to say, about 50% of them were, I threw back in the water. I was like, that just doesn't resonate with me. I don't hear it. But the 50% I did do, actually it's probably more than that, because there's 10 here. I know I picked from about 30 or 35. But I guess, half of them right away, it was like, no way. And then what was left, I curated, a shorter list. Frank Strozier's music is the music of a young cat in his late teens, early 20s, who's lighting up the scene. He's on fire, and this is good for kids now to hear. The late teens, early 20s kids that want to make a splash, you should check out what Frank Strozier did with his time when he was like that. It's a short time in your life. You think it's going to be forever, but then all of a sudden you're 30, and it's different. His music is, he dips into Coltrane's vocabulary a bit, but he never makes it symmetrical, which is nice. It's always off. In some way, everything's offset, like a Miro, Mondrian, Chagall. Things are just a little bit, too long or too short in some respect. Whereas Coltrane's really, really patterned out. So in that, I hear a poetic content. There's something poetic about his choices, very melodic. One thing I'm not able to do when I do these tributes, by the way, there was another one, Thelonious Monk. I just did a 90
Thelonious Monk, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Of his with a big band. In Freddie Redd's case, I could get his play. And in Teddy Charles' case, I did record with him. And so we had the example of how he played. But, you know, Frank, he's alive, but he doesn't play anymore. And he wouldn't anyway. He's not really taking anyone's phone calls. So I'm not going to play anything that he would play. You know, I'm not going to be an actor. I'm not Robert De Niro on the saxophone. I'm me. But I was inspired by something about his playing, an aspect of sort of this youthfulness, you know, really going after an idea with full abandon. And that's fun, you know. This record was a blast. It was really kind of going for it in a way like when you're in your early 20s. You don't care so much about how you look to everyone else. You're going to do whatever you want to do, and you just go for it. And there was something about this CD that was like that.
Frank Strozier, who actually grew up in Memphis, not too far away from where I live.
That's right.
He's a Tennessee guy. That's right. But he moved to Chicago, moved to New York City, you know, played with Miles Davis there. He is, as you mentioned, not very well known these days, but I've always had a soft spot in my heart for his music. You know, records like the one I have here, Cool, Calm, and Collected, which is definitely true about his playing on that, on that album. And then Long Night is another album I really like by him, which both of which are fortunately available on CD. And he has played, you know, with great musicians like Chet Baker and, you know, Shelly Manne and Don Ellis. He lived in California for a while. I'm not sure if he still lives there or not.
Yeah, I believe he's in Rhode Island.
Yeah. But, you know, not much has been written about him, you know, other than, of course, that great website that Noel has, where he has all, you know, the great information about the discography, which is, you know, invaluable to people like me who are always interested in knowing who plays on what record and when they were recorded and that sort of thing. But maybe there's a few articles by Mark Myers on his blog about Frank, but not a lot has been written about him. So this CD is a great source of knowledge about, you know, what Frank Strozier sounds like, but filtered through the lens of Chris Byers. It's a septet album as well, and, you know, many of the musicians that you've talked about, like Pasquale Grasso and Ari Roland, appear on this album. Definitely recommended the music of Frank Strozier by Chris Byers, and it's got a picture of you on one side, and youthful picture. Well, youth, not it, what would you say, of Strozier on the left?
I think he's younger than I am now. That looks like he might be, you know, late 30s. I don't know. I don't know the guy, but you know, he was a young cat, and that would have been a little bit later in his career, I think. You know,
I don't think he's recorded anything since the 1970s or so.
No, he, as told to me by fellow Tennessean Harold Mayburn, Frank grew to be disenchanted with the level of appreciation that he was getting. And you know, there's a Malcolm Gladwell book called Outliers, which talks about what it means to be born at the right time in the right place in the right profession. And Frank was coming in at the end of a crest of interest. And what that feels like is that every year there's less interest in what you're doing, which is a drag, you know. I mean, what he saw from when he was born, where the music was, to when he was like a full mature player, that went from, like, I guess the early bebop era to the end of the 60s. That's totally different, you know. At the early bebop era, jazz was the world, you know, the nation's popular music. Everyone knew it. Jazz stars were pop stars. By the end of the 60s, it's totally different. You know, it was a niche market. And every day along the way, it was just waning and waning and waning. Now, I'm born in 1970. I never knew the way it was, so I didn't get that kind of downturn. But all my heroes had to deal with it. Teddy Charles, he went to become a sailboat captain. G.G. Grice went to teach. Lucky Thompson lost his mind. Everyone had to do their own thing, you know, to get by on the kind of recession of interest. Frank, you know, he got really upset with the amount of attention that, like, John Coltrane was getting, for example. And he said, all right, I'm good at piano, so I'm going to play piano now. And as Harold Mayring put it, he went and practiced for a while, but what he didn't realize was that there was a whole line of pianists right around the corner ready, as he put it, to whoop his ass. You know, Frank was a pro-level saxophonist on a very high level. To expect that on another instrument, you know, it's like Michael Jordan played baseball.
And I was going to say that.
Yeah, you know, and he was probably pretty good at baseball, but he went out and kept striking out in the major leagues. He was Michael Jordan in the basketball. Frank Strozzi like Michael Jordan on the saxophone, but on the piano, he was Michael Jordan in baseball. You know? So that's, I think that was the end of the road for him. After that, he I think, became a science teacher. And you know, did 20 years and got his pension, and he's currently, you know, resting comfortably in a retirement home.
And not wanting to play another note of music, right?
He doesn't answer his phone. Like, he has people that call him every year on his birthday, Gary Smullyan, Harold Mayburn, and he won't talk to them. Like, he has really sealed the door, and that's an option. I mean, this doesn't have to be a life appointment. You know, you can be great and do wonderful things and then go do something else with your life. It doesn't have to be till death do us part with jazz. You know, I understand. It's fine.
And what you were talking about now just reminds me of something I always tell my wife, Erin, who, it's wonderful that she also likes jazz like I do, because otherwise, how could she be married to me? I mean, I'd be driving her crazy with all those jazz records. But I always tell her, you know, I think... Sometimes I feel like maybe I was born a little too late. You know, the idea of turning on the radio in the 1940s and 30s, and, you know, even at the beginning of the 50s, and the popular music of the day was jazz music. That must have been fantastic for those people who were actually able to live through that in the United States. Of course, that is long gone, and there were many problems back in the day as well, and not everybody who played jazz became famous. But that's a dream that I sometimes have. You know, maybe going back in time and be able to turn one of those different radio networks that they had back in the days and listen to an air check or listen to a remote broadcast or, you know, something like that, where actually jazz was being brought into the homes of people in its live format that you were talking about before.
Mm.
That would have been fantastic, really. If I had a wish, that might have been it.
Anton, well, it's very romantic and sentimental of you to think that way, and I would refer you to a very funny movie by Woody Allen. I believe it's To Paris with Love. Is that what it's called?
I think, or maybe Paris. Is it From Paris with Love? Or,
thank
or,
you.
From or is Paris it Midnight in Love. Paris? I can't remember now.
That's it, Midnight in Paris,
there you go.
They keep going back in time, and everyone they meet in the new time says, yeah, this is great, but you should have been here 30 years ago. That was really great. And he just keeps going back further, and everyone keeps saying this. So in reality, we're all exactly where we should be. And if we're longing for another time, that's just because we have to bring that energy into the present moment for everyone's benefit. And it may be a little bit like, you know, when you're in a room and the air conditioning's too high, you know, and you're going like, I'm a little uncomfortable, but you're living and you need to, you know, adjust your expectations, but also bring that thing that you're missing, you know, into everyone else's life and say, hey, you know what, this is the way it should be, and this is the way it used to be, and this is the way, in terms of how I see it, this is the way it still is. Now check it out, you know, and you just... That's what we all have to do.
Yeah, and that kind of nostalgia actually, you know, could also be very dangerous in that, you know, we tend to romanticize the positive sides of the decades that we love, and then we tend to forget the many terrible things that happened.
Segregation, you know, all kind of jive stuff that was going on, and we've improved on all that. Dental health is a lot better.
Oh, tell me about that. I just had a root canal about a couple of days ago.
So. Well, you could have had 16 of them by now if it had been 60 years ago. So, you know, yeah, we're doing better. We're doing better.
You're listening to a new episode of the Jazz Flashers podcast. My name is Anton Garcia Fernandez, talking to you from Tennessee, and we have Chris Byers on the other side of the line today. This podcast will be available on iTunes and also on YouTube, and you can also find it in Jazz Flashers, the blog, that you can find at jazzflashers.blogspot.com. Now, the other record I have here in front of my, right in front of me is... Chris Byers, Two Fives, and this CD actually was recorded in March of 2014, also released on Steeplechase from Denmark in 2015, so about a couple of years ago or so. And, you know, when I listen to this record, I think, Chris, that this CD actually encapsulates really well what your music is about, because we have two fives, so five originals, five tunes written by others, and tendency that you have and that I like so much to celebrate jazz history while at the same time looking into the future. And I really would think, I mean, I don't know if you agree, you're the one that made the record, I'm just the listener of the record, but I really think it does encapsulate really well, from the actual title of it and the content of it, you know, what your jazz music is about.
Thank you, Anton. Well, you hit it right on the head. I'm trying to kind of be like, you know, the what was it on the Roman coin that looked both ways? Janus, I think.
That's right.
What the month January is named after. Mm-hmm. And to look forward and backward at the same time. Yeah, it's trying to put, you know, five of mine up next to five songs of, you know, other composers. Now, one is to be honest, a remnant from the Duke Jordan record that didn't make it on that record, and we had it in the can, so we put it on this record.
But that's Lady Linda. Nice.
Lady Linda, that fit in well with the set order. And I was happy to get a Tad Dameron one in there, this Soul Train.
Soul Train, yeah.
Which is funny. That was penned in advance of the 70s dance show. That's not Soul Train, you know.
It's actually, you know, T-R-A-N-E, right?
Yeah.
Like John Coltrane.
Yeah, to refer to him, yeah. And that I would love to do a retrospective of Tad Dameron, and it's centennial this year. I was hoping to get around to it, so maybe something will come up this year, and I'll get to do a program of his. Danny Boy is a special song for me because I'm part Irish. My grandmother was a Kelly, spelled E-Y at the end, which is some mm-hmm. kind of Irish, I suppose. And
that's one I was going to ask you about, really, because, of course, it's a, you know, traditional Irish tune. And, you know, many people have recorded this song over the years in different styles of music, too, you know, from Elvis Presley to, you know. But in jazz, I really love the version of it by Ben Webster. I don't know if that's something that was on your mind as you were playing this or not, but it really, in a way, has become a standard, even though it's not really a jazz tune.
Well, you know, see, Anton, that's why I'm glad we're talking. I didn't know about the Ben Webster recording. I'll have to check it out. So if that's meant a lot to you, it's definitely worth me hearing. And that's why we're all here for each other, is to share this kind of information. And this is great. I can look forward. I'm going to have a great 5 minutes some later tonight to, you know, listening to that. I'm looking forward to that. So no, I was not aware of that.
Well, I believe he recorded it live many times, you know, in the latter part of his career when he had moved to Europe and, you know, was living in different European countries and was performing live with just basically, you know, local rhythm sections. It was basically Ben Webster and some local rhythm section of, you know, really good musicians that played with him. And a lot of the recordings of Danny Boy by Ben Webster I remember are actually live recordings of the song. It becomes sort of like a staple of his later years, like, for example, the standard Sunday, which he used to play a lot, and, you know, several others. So yeah, that's what I was thinking about. And whenever I listen to this tune done in the jazz version, I always think of Ben Webster, who's always been one of my favorite saxophone players.
Yeah, it's so tremendous, so strong.
Now, when you write these five tunes, you know, there's Little India, Taxi Bird, Express, Hello Pork Pie Hat, and Burk Bop. You know, how do the classic jazz compositions that you love so much and that are also very present in your repertoire, how do they shape or influence the tunes that you write?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what it's like. They are the little angels on the shoulder. They are advisors, but not, you know, like in charge of executive function. You still have to make your decisions and you know, come up with your way of carrying the ball forward musically. But with the amount of, you know, kind of reference material that I've experienced, if there becomes an issue, like, how should I deal with this part? What would this guy do? What would that guy do? Then it's really helpful. So it's incremental. It's like a 5% boost. You know, it's not a given. I'm not, because then I'd just be writing their songs. Yeah, these are all, you know, things that I came up with in the process of composing. Is something you really can't do quickly. You have to sit there and ferment. You know, you got to like stew and mull it over it. And even that needs a spark in advance of that, some like kind of quick download from the universe of like some rhythmic idea or melodic fragment. That it's really, that's a very strange thing. You don't know where it's coming from, but it's in your head, and you go, I better put this down, you know, before it escapes me. Honestly, Anton, I don't know where how do you start humming a tune that you don't know? Like, where did that come from? Mm-hmm. So, you know, then you kind of shape it and fashion it and develop it. You know, if you want to go with a certain form, AABA, you get a fragment, you repeat it, and then you come over with the contrasting fragment, the B section, and then you close with the original. Or there's this binary form, which is a longer, you know, 16-bar as opposed to 8-bar segment that starts one way and then you repeat it, but it ends differently. And those are the two general song forms I write in. You know, the AABA or the binary ABAC form. But, you know, it doesn't have to be that. I have done other forms and also large groupings of music. Generally, the way to write a 25-minute piece is to write, you know, 6 4-minute pieces with some transitions. Mm-hmm. That's the way you're going to do that. So it is. It's back to this again, but you can expand and use other building blocks. These particular songs were conceived with the instruments in mind, the people that are on this record. And, you know, speaking really almost specifically about the addition of Pasquale Grasso, mm-hmm. I think this was the second one that he was on. The first one he was on was the Duke Jordan, so it was a little bit more controlled what he was going to do there. This is the original half of it, and you know, I could really decide what he was going to do. And he's a really versatile player. It's like having a new player on a football team that's like great on offense and defense. Like, wow, how do we use this guy? Because he can play written parts. He's all my instrumentalists, I realize, they're all like classically trained to the point of like they're all conservatory trained. Mm-hmm. So they can all read difficult stuff. They all have attention to intonation and phrasing like a classical musician would. And Pasquale, you know, he'll sit down and, well, I don't know if you know how good he is. I mean, this guy is, Pat Metheny says he's the best guy in the world. So Pat pretty much knows what he's talking about.
He's
a good guy. Pat says a lot of cool things. You know, he's very thoughtful. I had him in mind with this. He's in our ensemble. He's one of the four horns. Mm-hmm. Which is really fun for a writer to have somebody like that. He's serving two roles.
In this case, it's a sextet album, and a lot of the musicians actually appear also on the Frank Strozier album, which was recorded later, right?
Yeah, this is my set band. The addition would be my dad on oboe and English horn. Which, you know, sometimes he's on a record, sometimes he's not. Sometimes he's on one song or two songs. As I said earlier, he's the main reason why I play jazz. And so I love having him as part of it. But also, it's like, who has oboe in their group? Who has English horn? It's an unusual sound. And mm-hmm. you know, he can elevate something from being cool to really unusually cool, when he participates. So... but this was just our sextet. It's still, this is my sextet. These are the guys, you know, when someone says, do you have a band? Yeah, that's my band. And we have a new record, actually. We recorded in January, and it'll come out in 8 months or so. Steeplechase takes a while to hatch their eggs. It's because they have so many in the pipeline. And so everything always takes a year or two to come out. And for that record, it's the sextet again. It's called New York City Jazz, ironically, kind of what we're talking about in this interview. And, it's more of this great fun with this Pasquale Grasso guy. And everybody, you know. I call it my Italian band. We've got Stefano Doglioni, John Mosca is an Italian-American, mm-hmm. and Pasquale. My band is half Italian.
Well, when you were mentioning, you know, Pasquale Grasso being a conservatory-trained musician, I'm sure this is something that has been asked of you many times, but when it comes to playing jazz and at the same time being classically conservatory-trained, do you think there's something in spontaneity that is lost, or is it actually an asset to play jazz, to be classically trained like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, great question, Anton. You got to be careful about what you learn and what you fall in love with and not get seduced by it. For example, now, I've had some friends that got into Latin music and we lost them. They're not playing jazz anymore. And Latin music is that great that you can say, this is all I want to do. You know, you got to stay true with your original plan. You got to stick to the plan, whatever that plan was. But, you know, be like, who was it, Odysseus? You know, he got tied to the mast, but he told the sailors, you know, take the wax out of my ears. I want to hear what the sirens are singing, you know. And then he drifted by them and he said, guys, I was kidding. Untie me. I got to go hang out with them. They're great. And they say, we can't hear you. You know, I don't know what you're saying, boss. I'm not telling you. So, you know, we have to be like that. And if you're like that, yeah, you can learn as much classical music as you want. Just realize, like, your ethic as a jazz player is swinging and improvising and playing the blues. And classical music is not about swinging. It's not about improvising. And it's not about playing the blues. I mean, unless you're talking some kind of abstract way of interpreting it.
Some sort of George Gershwin composition or something.
Yeah, but really you'll get in trouble in the orchestra if you play that like a jazz player. They want it a little more straight, a little more yatta-ta-ta-ta. And when we started, you know, adopting that aesthetic, yeah, it can be problematic, but there's so much to learn. Mm-hmm. There's the clarity and the control, the wide, oh my God, the repertoire. They've got more great music for you to listen to then we have time left in our lives. So it's just a question of what do I not want to miss? Like, oh,
okay, let's check out Wagner. Well, there goes like 6 months, you know?
You know, when I was a kid and I saw one of those concerts for young people that Leonard Bernstein, I think, did at Carnegie Hall, was it? Because my dad is a huge collector of books and records of all kinds, not just jazz, but also jazz. But he particularly really likes classical music. And he was, now he's retired, but he was a high school teacher for over 40 years. And it is really because of him that I am a professor myself and that I have this love of music and of literature. And I think, you know, I remember watching this with him with, you know, Spanish subtitles back when I was maybe, you know, 9 or 8. I can't remember just about. And I remember very clearly that Leonard Bernstein said the difference between classical music and jazz is that classical music is exact music. Meaning that I think he meant that the composers usually tell you how they want the piece to be played, and so, like you're saying, there's no swing, there's no improvisation of any kind. I don't know what I think about that. I don't think it's axiomatic, you know. I don't think that is the just the perfect way to describe it. But it's something that has somehow stuck to my mind all these years, and now, you know, 30 some years later, I can still remember that phrase, and I sometimes think about that. And maybe he's not that far off the mark.
Well, I want to expand on that and share an idea with you, which is something that came to my attention recently in the Monk tribute. Monk really didn't care how you soloed. When it was your turn, if you wanted to prove in front of everybody that you're an ignorant, you know, sloth, go ahead. That's on you. It's not on him. He's going to comp for you just like he would anybody else, and he's going to challenge you and spur you on and try to make you better than you really are. But however good you are, that you'll be judged for that, and it's a contest of one, you know. What he cared about was, hey, don't mess me up. When it's time for my solo, don't mess me up. When we're playing my song, don't mess up my song, right? That's the team part of it. But I also saw this in three other instances, and they're worth mentioning. Thad Jones really didn't care how you soloed. Not that it would be on a good or bad level, but like, you know, Joe Farrell, that was some avant-garde stuff. Steve Coleman, that was bizarre. You know, he had some wild cats in there, and that was fine. Hey, it's your solo. Go nuts. Go be as individual as you want. Duke Ellington, same thing. He wanted you, and he would... for example, Steve Little told me a story about playing in the band when he took over for Sam Woodyard in the 60s. Duke had no drum parts, never wrote a drum part. Mm-hmm. And so Steve said, well, you know, hey, Duke, you don't have any music for me, and I don't know the songs. Can I at least listen to some recordings? And Duke said, no, you can't. Just show up and play. And he'd have to play like these advanced suites and everything with no chart and no rehearsal and no recording of it. Because Duke wanted, you know, I want to hear you. How did you play? I don't want to hear what the next guy did or the last guy did. And then the last example was Prez, who told the drummer, he says, I don't care if you take a hatchet to your drums. Just give me that titty-boom, titty-boom on the ride cymbal when I'm soloing, and then we're all fine. So it really is all for Monk, Thad Jones, Duke, and Prez. If it's good enough for them, I think that's pretty much what the aesthetic is. It's about the solos, and what you're saying about exact music, they wouldn't stand for that in classical music. They'll tell a soloist, hey, you got to hear it this way, you know. That thing you're doing, you know, I'm hearing it this way. Or I know what the composer would have wanted. I'll sing it to you. Play it more like this. In jazz, you know, that'll just turn you loose. Go ahead, do your thing. So I think that's the difference. And in that way, Bernstein, I think, was right. It's an exact music.
I've heard people say that Duke Ellington used the orchestra as an instrument, and I think that's a pretty good way of putting or describing you know, the way that that he wrote for his orchestra. But what I really think is that besides that, he really knew his soloists very well, and he knew that he could rely on people like Johnny Hodges and, you know, all the great Ellingtonians that played in his outfits for, you know, so many decades. And why so many of them stayed for so long, I think it's probably because they understood that Duke Ellington understood their own individuality within the orchestra. It wasn't necessarily his orchestra, but it was him leading an orchestra of individuals who knew what they could and wanted to do.
Well, it's exactly what that was the case, and they would sound better as themselves under his environment than they would out there on their own, because he would set it up for them, and he knew how to do that. But, you know, as a writer, you need to do this, and I would say that's all the writers out there. When you write your note for that person, think of them. See their face in the little note head, and imagine them playing that note or that phrase or that part, and sing it the way they would play. Because if you know who they are, you know how they play.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to have a better chance at hitting the mark like Duke did.
It's like a playwright writing a play for a specific actor or a specific cast of actors, right?
Exactly.
Because really the interesting thing is that really music always needs somebody to play the music. The music itself doesn't exist without somebody that plays it, just like a play doesn't necessarily exist really until it is put on stage. So I think that really is a great comment, Chris. I finally have in my hand this album that I really love, and I must, you know, not that you have to be objective, because I don't think anyone can be objective when describing the music they love, and you don't even need to strive for that, I don't think. But this album I have in my hand, Freddie Redd, With Due Respect, and underneath the title we have the names of Chris Byers, John Mosca, Stefano Doglioni, Jay Anderson, and Billy Drummond. This album also released by Steeplechase. So all three of the albums we're talking about today were released by that great Danish label over in Klampenborg, Denmark, Steeplechase. This album is really a jewel for those of us who love the music of Freddie Redd and who have heard the great Blue Note sessions that he, not too many, he didn't really record a lot, but those that he did are fantastic, from the 1960s. Now, how did this project come about, Chris?
Well, I played with Freddie a couple of times at Birdland and at Smalls, and Nils Winther of Steeplechase was interested in recording Freddie, and it took a few years. They wouldn't come to terms right away, but eventually it became possible, and I got Freddie out there, and Nils was just so thrilled to have somebody on Freddie's level. You know, Freddie's the last living pianist who played quartet with Charlie Parker. They're all gone now. Hank Jones, Duke Jordan, they're all gone. This is the last guy. And he sat down and recorded, what was it, like 35 minutes of usable material in one set, just banged it out. This is when he was 83?
Mm-hmm.
82, 83, I mean.
Yeah, in his early 80s anyway, because he was born in New York in 1928, so.
Oh, that's right. So, no, he was 85 then. And he's turning 89 next month. He lives pretty close to me, and I'm going to go see him probably this week, play him some music, and he's in a retirement home. You know, he's got a little CD player there. I'll bring him some CDs and hang out. He's a lot of fun to be with. So, yeah, Freddie did two records. There's one, what's it called?
Well, one of them is, the one I remember the most is Shades of Red.
Yeah,
in 1960, which is my favorite that I've heard by him.
Yeah, that's an amazing.
But he also wrote the music for the play The Connections, which I believe he also turned into an album for Blue Note.
I would say The Connection and Shades of Red are the two best of that era. And then coming in a close third is Red's Blues,
mm-hmm.
and then a couple of lesser known ones. Lonely City is great, and the one that has the San Francisco Suite is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So, but actually, no, this is a record he did in 2015. See, he came in and did more than an album's worth of music, and so Nils got him back in for a second record, which is a good trick. I advise all of our musicians out there to do that. Go when you show up, do 90 minutes of music. If somebody's into you, they'll say, "Oh, let's finish that second one," and you get to do another date. So his the first CD was organized as a trio because I didn't play on that. And that's called Music for You. And then he released With Due Respect, I guess a year later, 2016. And I don't know if Freddie's going to play again. He may record again. He may play again. I don't think he's going to record again. The hands are locking up on him. He would need a reversal of a kind of arthritic carpal tunnel thing, which is pretty hard at late 80s. Might happen. You know, we'll see. So this might be the last two that he does. And they're wonderful. He plays great, so sincere and heartfelt. I feel like Freddie plays happy music. It's happy. Mm-hmm. It's not advanced. Bud Powell was his hero, but he can't do what Bud did. He points the ship in that direction and then goes half as fast. You know, for a lot of us, that's more human and more listenable, more understandable. The sincere joy in his music is just so beautiful, you know. And sure enough, that's what he's like to be around. You know, he's just a sweetheart. He's a great guy, funny. You'll just laugh when you're with him. It's a joke every couple of seconds. Just a great kid. That was a great day. Billy Drummond hit it out of the park on drums. And I arranged some three-horn charts, and they sounded pretty good. We did some tunes that he knew, but a couple of new ones that he had. I coaxed a few out of him in this century. He had pretty much stopped writing, and I got him to do a ballad and a blues that are on that record. So, yeah, Freddie. I gotta see him. Every day that he's with us is a treasure, and I don't want to miss it. I'm gonna go see him this week.
You know, back in the '90s in Spain, they brought out this collection of CDs that were all Blue Note records, and they would be released like every 2 weeks or something like that. You can go and, you know, they were, of course, the back catalog of Blue Note, going back to late 50s, early 60s, early 70s, you know, that sort of thing.
And what was that label? Was it Mosaic?
It was just something that was being released in certain European countries, I remember. And it was a collection of CDs that would come out every 2 weeks. I think two per issue, you know, like you would buy this installment, you know, and it would be two CDs of Blue Note records. And, you know, it was anything from, you know, Sinatra Swinging Session, which he actually did for Capitol and not for Blue Note, but he was on there somehow contractually. It was okay to do that. Anything from that to, you know, some Bud Powell and Bird, and all sorts of great classic records that were made in the 50s and 60s that were all released, or mostly all of them released on Blue Note Records. And I remember that was how I first heard Shades of Red, by Freddie Red, which, you know, I had never heard of before, and I was instantly hooked on that record. I listened to it over and over again, and now that you describe the way that he is in person, I think those Shades of Red were mostly happy shades, but like you're saying, and that might be one of the things that attracted me to that record from the get-go, from the very first time I ever heard it. Now on this album, With Due Respect, you actually do the arrangements as well, right? When you are arranging tunes by Freddie Red or Lucky Thompson, or, you know, Gigi Grise, Duke Jordan. How do you approach the arranging? What are you thinking of? What do you want to project as you take these tunes, some of them better known than others, but most of them, many of them fairly obscure? How do you work on them? What is your intention when you're doing this?
Well, arranging is kind of like the guy that comes in and fixes the cabinets in your kitchen. It's a funny job. You got to be appropriate and useful. You don't want to waste an effort. You don't want to make a big show. Look how I arranged this. You got to be a little more invisible than that. And you're an assistant to the composer and also an assistant to the musicians. You want to facilitate the intent of the composer and highlight the strengths of the musicians and to make them feel supported. And so it's actually an easy job in a way because the intent is clear. Whereas, how do you sound like yourself as a player? Oh, that's hard. How do you write your own song? Man, I don't even know what to tell you. But as an arranger, hey, help everyone sound good with what they're already doing. That's not so confusing in a way. It's a clear mission. Some things like, one, you got to really make sure you're not messing up the melody. Learn every note of it, because when you write it out, if you mess it up, you're damaging it. You're knocking a front tooth out of this thing. Like, please. But then you have to pay attention to the flow and realize that writers, while we write out of time, because you can go back and fix something, when it's played, it's in time. And you have to judge the effect of time on the listener and on the musician. You have to relieve the fatigue that happens of like repetitive statements, certain areas like too many high notes we get tired of. If the phrases always go down, too many times of that, it's like, hey, is it raining or something? What's going on? So variety, you have to try to balance all these little things. But it's so behind the scenes, imagine a fashion show, right? You're the person making sure that the clothes go on the model right before she walks out. You're not the model and you're not the designer. You're helping. And it's in a way, it's like a very clear mission. So I had a great time. You kidding? Like Freddie Redd. It's not a silk purse out of a sow's ear. This is a joy. This is like, oh, I can make that sound good. It already sounds good. I don't have to do anything.
Now, all these three albums were released by the Danish label Steeplechase, but where were they recorded? Did you fly to Europe to make these recordings, or did you record them in the United States, ship the masters over there? How did that happen?
Oh, he comes in. Nils comes in to the United States, of course. Denmark is, a place to be departed from in January and February if you can, because there's no sunshine and it's very cold. So he'll go to South Carolina, and on his way down and on his way back, he comes through New York and records like 10 CDs. He'll book a hotel for like a week and a half and go and do one or two a day. And get a bunch of people to record for him. So I've been lucky to be on, that rotation. But he's pumping out still dozens of different artists, year to year. And, so it's in New Jersey. We go to the studio in New Jersey. Trading Eights Studio, Chris Salit. He's an excellent engineer.
Well, those are definitely three excellent records that in... I keep calling them records because, to me they are records. That's what they are. Now, people call them CDs, not LPs. Or it's not vinyl anymore, although they say it's coming back and that sort of thing. But I always call everything, no matter, if it's a 78 or a 33 and a third or 45 or a CD, whatever it is, I always call it record. It might be, part of my old-fashioned mentality about, you know, being a big fan of really old jazz in some cases, and you That's know, funny. Back when everyone called them records. But in any case, Chris, I want to thank you so much for your participation in this episode of the podcast. It's been really a huge pleasure for me. Not only have I learned a lot, but I have had a great time chatting with you. And I know you wanted to record about an hour or so. I think we've gone in excess of that. But, you know, we'll just make it available and people out there can listen to it in installments. And I'll half an hour one day, half an hour another day, or maybe the whole way through. It doesn't matter. But it really has been a pleasure for me to have you here. Chris Byers is our guest on this episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast. And the records, to finish, are again Chris Byers' 2 5s, the music of Frank Strozier, and also this Freddie Redd album, With Due Respect, all of them released by Steeplechase. Could you please tell us, Chris, how to find out more information about you there on the internet? Of course, you have a Facebook page, but besides that, where else can we find information about Chris Byers and his activities?
Well, specifically on Facebook, Chris Byers Jazz, and you got to know how to spell Byers. It's like Don Byers with an R, or Billy Byers with an A, if you know your jazz. If you don't know your jazz, that's B-Y-A-R-S, Chris Byers Jazz. Otherwise, you got to send me your friend request, and generally, if I don't know somebody, I don't accept them. I'm getting near my limit. So Chris Byers Jazz is good. There's also chrisbyers.com. And that's a website, you know, has links to the CDs. And you can just Google me. You know, there's stuff out there that, you know, on YouTube and Amazon, and Chris Byers Jazz, something will come up. If it doesn't come up, I'm not doing my job. I need to get back on it. So then that's my fault. So I do hope to get in touch with your listeners, and I hope they reach out to me. That would be fun to make some new connections. But I do want to say just briefly, Anton, thank you for doing this and making this available to everybody, as you do often, on many different fronts and aspects of this music. And it is interest like yours, you know, that is truly rare. Out of the two people in this conversation, you are the uncommon one. And I really do appreciate that, and I want to encourage that and encourage others that may feel like they can do something like you're doing, go ahead. We need more people like you doing what you do, listening patiently, asking thoughtful questions, and putting the information out there and sharing it with others. Then we're going to be okay.
Well, thank you. I just wish I were a little bit more, you know, tech savvy than I really am, but, you know, I do my best. The truth is that, you know, I feel like people should have, and I don't think that everybody, unfortunately, out there does, but people need to have other interests in their lives outside of their work. And when you're a professor, and you have so many classes to prepare and exams to grade and, you know, that sort of thing, you in order to find balance in your life, you need some hobbies to speak of, you know. And for me, you know, besides, of course, being with my family, my daughter and my wife, and, you know, meeting with friends, and, you know, most of whom, by the way, are not jazz fans. Jazz is something that has, over the years, over many years, because I think I was about 10 or 11 the first time I ever really consciously heard a jazz album, and it was a Bill Evans album, I remember that. Over the years, jazz has been a constant companion anywhere I go, and it has always been something that, you know, keeps me sane, keeps me happy, keeps me thoughtful, and just keeps me alive in many ways. And that's why I do this, of course, not for the money, not for notoriety or anything like that, but just because I truly love the music and I truly love people like you. So if there is a reason why I do this, it's because there are people like you who play the music and make us happy, us listeners out here. This has been a new episode of the Jazz Flashes podcast with Anton Garcia Fernandez, talking to you from Martin, Tennessee. You will be able to access this podcast on iTunes, also on YouTube, and also on the Jazz Flashes blog, where I write my short articles about jazz whenever I have the time, and that's at jazzflashes.blogspot.com. We've had as a guest today New York saxophonist and clarinetist and flutist as well. He's a multi-instrumentalist, the great Chris Byers. Thank you very much, Chris. I really appreciate it, and I hope to be in touch with you, and maybe we can do something like this again soon whenever you have a new record out.
Anytime, Anton. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.